You're listening to the Talking Rheumatology podcast, brought to you by the British Society for Rheumatology.
Welcome to this Talking Rheumatology podcast. I'm Ros Benson, I'm a rheumatology consultant in Liverpool, and I'm the digital learning editor at the BSR. This pod gives an opportunity to hear from Lara Chapman, Caroline Cotton and Mark Russell about the experience of authoring guidelines. It covers everything you need to know about the BSR guidelines, what they are, insights into the process and how to get involved, including some top tips for applications and why you might like to. I'm delighted to have them join me today, and I'm going to ask them in turn to introduce themselves. I'm going to start with Lara.
Hi, thank you. So I'm Lara Chapman. I'm a podiatrist at Harrogate and District NHS Foundation Trust and an NIHR Clinical Doctoral Research Fellow at the University of Leeds. And I'm lead author of the new BSR guideline for foot health in inflammatory arthritis.
That's brilliant. Thank you. And then if I go to Caroline.
Yeah, so I'm Caroline Cotton. I'm one of the rheumatology consultants at Liverpool. I started as a trainee representative on the guideline working group and then moved to one of the consultants on the group once I finished my training. I also take a lead role in some of the guidelines that are being written at the moment for systemic sclerosis and ILD as a LinkedIn member for the guideline group.
Thanks very much, Caroline. And Mark, if I come to you.
Thanks very much. So hi, I'm Mark. So I'm a rheumatology specialty trainee towards the end of my training, also an academic trainee. So recently finished an NIHR PhD at King's College London. I led the systematic literature research and evidence synthesis for the BSR guideline on prescribing immunomodulatory drugs in pregnancy, which was published last year. I also recently joined the hot swollen joint guideline as a member of the working group.
Brilliant. So we've got a wealth of experience from you all. So thank you for joining me. So I might go to you, Mark, first of all. How did you apply to join a guideline working group as a trainee representative?
So I think the way I applied is changed quite a little bit since when I first joined the pregnancy guideline group. So back then, I was just starting my PhD. It was slightly fortuitous in that at King's, we've had quite a lot of experience in formulating guidelines, evidence synthesis, etc. So I got involved through that route, but it's changed quite a lot more recently. It's much more structured and arguably more straightforward now. So any new guidelines tend to be advertised through BSR social media, through the newsletters, and you can contact, there's an email address on there you can contact for further information. There's also a role description and sort of trainee specification that they publish on the BSR website too. So it gives you lots of information about why you might be suitable for that. And then once you've decided that you might want to apply for it, there's this online application form, but it's not like filling in a PhD application. It's pretty straightforward. There's about, if I remember correctly, 5 or 6 questions on there that cover things like why you want to be involved on that in that particular guideline, things like why you feel you might work well with other members of the team, and it's pretty straightforward to fill in. It wasn't too onerous.
That's great. And I mean, Caroline, I think, did you apply as a trainee as well to be part of the guideline committee?
So I had to in the application form through at the time. But I think, again, it might be a little bit more formal now.
And now you're more in a leadership role within the guideline groups that you're writing guidelines for. What would you say the guideline chairs are looking for when they see applications from trainees?
I think they like to see that somebody has an interest in the guideline that they want to be involved in, that maybe they've done some projects in that area and have a little bit of experience with that area. Usually they try and get a couple of trainees involved.
Brilliant. So actually it's a something that our trainees can look to do definitely in the future, it seems. And Lara, you've been involved in guidelines, as you've explained before previously. Can you tell us a bit more about what the role involves and the commitment that's required?
Yeah, so typically there's 4 meetings per year, and these are all held online. And all members of the guideline working group are invited to discuss the evidence and formulate recommendations. Each group also has to develop a guideline scope, and this is published in Rheumatology Advances in Practice. So this involved establishing the questions we wanted our guideline and therefore the systematic review underpinning the guideline to address. And this was all done in PICO format, so population, intervention, comparator and outcome. And for our foot health guideline, we developed 19 key questions. We designed the literature search strategies with information specialists at Keele University, and they did an amazing job of finding all of the evidence for each of our questions. And we split up the paper screening and data extraction between group members prior to meetings where we presented and discussed the evidence. And then as lead author, my main role has obviously been to lead the write-up of the guideline for publication in Rheumatology, with everyone in the group helping with this.
That's brilliant. So it's quite an involved process, isn't it? How long does it take, would you say, from start to finish, writing a guideline?
I think it's taken 2 years in total for the whole process.
Yeah. And I think that leads on to my next question, really, which is, I suspect by undertaking all of those literature reviews and all of the reading of evidence that is required, that you learn a lot from writing and being part of these guideline development groups. Can I come to each of you in turn to see what you've learned specifically from the experience and how has it helped you also then in your career development? I might go to Mark first, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So I really enjoyed the process, actually, and it taught me a lot. It definitely taught me about time management and working with your colleagues who you work, you know, in the guideline working group with the other trainees. I mean, it can appear slightly sort of daunting at the beginning. The pregnancy guideline was certainly a big guideline. There was lots of evidence. I remember running my initial search and there being, you know, 20,000 papers to screen at the beginning. And that can be intimidating. But then you remember that, well, actually, more than 95% of those you can screen out very quickly. It's not just you. You've got other trainees. You've got the whole, you know, wealth of people on the guideline working group to help you. We were looking after, so Prof Ian Giles led our guideline working group, and he was, you know, very, very helpful throughout all stages of that. And there's also lots of tools out there to help you. So things like Ovid for running your search, Ryan for managing your inclusion exclusion of particular studies are all very helpful examples of things you can do. But certainly from a career perspective, it's been, you know, really helpful. So clinically, you know, if I remember before being involved in the guideline, I did not used to enjoy, or it was one of the areas I was less comfortable about, was answering medication related queries in pregnancy, because I just didn't know the evidence base well. And whereas having been involved in it now, people come to you for your sort of expertise, having been involved and having reviewed the evidence. And then from a sort of an academic or career perspective, it's great to have been involved in the national guideline. And, you know, everything we do in practice, whether it's writing a paper, whether it's answering a clinical question, you're always synthesizing evidence. And so having learned that process was really, really important.
And I was really interested to hear, so Mark, there's obviously a lot of synthesizing evidence which goes on for all of the guideline developments. And Lara, you said that you had help from Keele University. Is that something that you have with the development of all the guidelines? Or if you have a specialist within the guideline working group, you seek their advice when you're collecting the and doing the literature reviews?
So, I mean, certainly from our perspective, we had quite a lot of in-house expertise at King's to help with that. So from literature searching, we also had back in our garden, we had a BSR representative there who sort of had lots of experience with doing literature searching. So I never felt like I was on my own developing my searches out of the blue. And it's very structured, the process, in terms of how you form your PICO statements, how you build your search. It's never that you feel like you're doing it sort of on the fly. So that it felt very supported in that regard.
And Caroline, how about you? How have you found the experience and how has it then aided your career development?
So I think it's been really good for keeping up to date. So when you're part of the guideline working group, you end up getting stay up to date with all the scopes that are coming in and then all the guidelines that are being written. And then you read the guidelines and have to give feedback. So it has to keep you quite up to date with your knowledge. You tend to then learn how guidelines are written, so how you identify who the key stakeholders are in guidelines. So it keeps things quite interesting in that respect.
And do you think, so from a clinical perspective, it's obviously useful then, I guess, as to how you can relate what you're learning with patients. And that's something that Mark's also talked about. And do you think that with your career, it's also helped progress having had this experience?
Yeah, definitely. It kept things up to date. It's good for knowing how to literature search, how to do those things. So it's been good.
And I'm sure, I guess, when it comes to applying for consultant jobs, which you did a couple of years ago, it's a useful thing, isn't it, I imagine, because it's quite unusual to have had this experience.
Definitely.
It displays a lot of skills. And Lara, if I come to you, how have you found it and what have you taken from it?
It's just been a fantastic opportunity to gain hands-on experience in all aspects of developing a guideline, which wasn't like anything I'd ever done before. So the whole experience has given me new skills in evidence appraisal and synthesis, and then in working with lots of experts in different areas, and also obviously in writing. And I think these are skills that I'll definitely be able to apply in other areas of my career going forwards. And it does feel like quite a big accomplishment to be the lead author of this guideline, the foot health guideline, because there's nothing else like it available for people working in this area of foot health. That's as comprehensive and up to date. So I think in terms of the impact that it could have for patient care, it's really important work, and that's very exciting.
Yeah, so it's something really to be proud of, isn't it, at the end of producing something like this?
Absolutely.
And Lara, you are a podiatrist. What have you found in terms of the guideline working groups, in terms of their overall makeup and the multidisciplinary team involvement?
Yeah, so BSL guideline working groups are multi-professional with representation from all over the UK. So in our foot health group, for example, we had podiatrists, rheumatologists, a nurse, a physio, orthopaedic surgeons, a GP and an orthotist. And the group included a mix of those working in adult and paediatric settings. We had a good range of purely clinical members and then some with a strong research background too. And our group members had different levels of experience in rheumatology as well. So I think the BSR guideline groups are very welcoming to everyone. And I definitely felt very supported through the whole process, particularly in terms of the support I received from our chair and our deputy chair. And I think also, you don't need to be someone who's had years and years of clinical experience. So when we started this process, I think I'd been qualified as a podiatrist for 5 years, and I worked mostly in general podiatry, but I felt like I could make valuable contributions in terms of, like, from the perspective of treating patients with foot problems in inflammatory arthritis, but not within specialist rheumatology settings. And then finally, and very importantly, guideline working groups also have experts by experience. So in our group, these were people who live with inflammatory arthritis or care for someone with IA. And these are the group members who really kept us grounded in reality with some of our recommendations.
I think that's a really, really important point that you've just made about having the lived experience of somebody within your guideline group. Mark, when I come to you, so with a rheumatology trainee who might be thinking about applying to join one of the guideline working groups, what would be your top tips that you could give them?
I think when it comes to making yourself competitive, the key thing that you should try and put across in the application is why you're passionate about that particular area, why you really want to be involved in that guideline. I think, you know, the application process, as I mentioned before, is not about how big your CV is, how many publications you've got in that particular area. It's much more about why you want to be involved in that field. So is this something you've had previous experience of? Is it an area you might like to subspecialize in the future? And so I think that's the thing that really, you know, comes across in it, and what should come across when you're writing your application, and sort of gives you the best chance of being successful. I think the other thing I would mention as well is in terms of time commitment, and that's always a tricky thing, and that will vary a lot by guideline. I think the pregnancy one was a big guideline. There's lots of evidence there, lots of new drugs, for example, that we need to collect evidence on. It would be a lie for me to say it's not a big time commitment. It is, but it's manageable. It's not that you have to have, you know, a year's dedicated time to focus on this alone and nothing else. You can't. I did it alongside other roles as well. But you need to think about whether you can. How is this a good time for you to sort of build in that time? And so if you've got your SCE exam coming up, or if you're writing, you know, an NIHR application, then this will significantly increase your workload on top of that. And it may be better, you might think, well, maybe I reapply to another guideline in a year's time, for example. But it is certainly manageable, and it's really good having a big team there to support you through the process too.
That's really helpful, Mark. Thank you. I mean, I think that's an interesting point that you make about working out where it is within your training programme and whether or not you've got the opportunity and the time and headspace really to give to a project like this.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just sort of planning ahead, really, isn't it? And thinking about that, but that it's very doable. That seems to be the message you're giving.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, so, you know, there's often you're aware that a particular guideline might be coming up in the future. And so you can sort of think ahead and think, well, you know, maybe this will be a good time for me to do it. And you can sort of think, well, I won't take on a different project at that particular time. I'll make sure that I have time free so that I can help out with that particular guideline working group, for example. So there is that. It's not just the case you need to decide over the course of, you know, 3 hours. You've got time to plan it.
And I guess actually seek advice from people like yourselves who have had experience doing it.
I'm very happy to be contacted by anyone to sort of give an idea of what's involved.
And Caroline, if I come to you now, so as being a member of the guideline steering group and then a linked member of the guideline working group, how have you found that?
Yeah, so the steering group itself meets twice a year, and during the year we're asked to make comments on any guidelines that are coming through, so any guideline scope and any guidelines that are coming through. So sometimes with this you won't have any emails for a few months, and then a few guidelines will all come in a bit of a flurry together. You're often given quite a lot of notice actually when things and BSR have been really good at that, so that you can plan, so that you know what amount of work is coming. Then when you're a LinkedIn member of the group, some groups you will get very involved in, and sometimes they maybe don't want quite as much input. And so as a linked member, you will make sure that guidelines, if there's any problems going on with guidelines, you can feed that back to the steering group. So that's sort of your role in that. But it depends on how much input they maybe require or you maybe want to take on as well.
Yeah. So some flexibility within it sounds, which is helpful. Yeah. So I guess there are limited numbers of places of people that can be part of a guideline working group. If somebody's keen and they apply and it may not be successful, are there other opportunities that they can take to get involved?
Yeah, so all the guidelines are shared for a draft consultation. So that's a good idea if you wanted to be involved in the review of those guidelines. And I think it's really important that people do feedback that new guidelines are out or some of the new guidance within teams in hospitals, and to keep people up to date. And I think the BSR are very good at sending out communications about new guidelines that are being published.
Absolutely. No, that's really helpful. So, I mean, I think we've covered quite a lot of different areas about the development of guidelines in our conversation. I don't know if there's anything else more that you feel you'd like to add before I can tell you what my take-home points are from this. We've covered most things. I'm very grateful for you all joining us today. It's been really good. I mean, I think that for me, it's very clear that actually, if this is something of interest, that there are opportunities to get involved, whether that be within the guideline working group or with reviewing draft guidelines when they come out for consultation, that actually it's not a totally unformidable task to do, that you can plan it within your work life, and actually that the benefits that you get from it both are to your clinical practice, but also in working with other members of multi-professional teams, but also research skills and developing literature searches and synthesis of evidence. I mean, I think it sounds really excellent, and I mean, we are very grateful for the guidelines that are produced by BSR because they have an impact on how we're able to best care for patients. So thank the people that have take the time to do it. So I would just finish the podcast really by saying that actually we've got some new guidelines which are coming up in the next couple of years. So in 2025 to 2026 there's the giant cell arteritis guideline. There'll be an update on this, again an update on the myositis and also the psoriatic arthritis guidelines. There's a call for new guideline topic proposals every summer, so feel free, and we encourage you to submit a proposal that will then be advertised via the usual BSR communication channels. And keep an eye out for calls for members to join up to the BSR guideline working groups. Thanks very much for listening, and if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd recommend that you look out for some of our others. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Talking Rheumatology, brought to you by BSR. Please do rate, share and subscribe through your favourite podcast app.